now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Dean Haglund, you were in Melbourne, were you not?
I certainly was at the AMC Expo, Australian Movie and Comic Book Expo, previously called Armageddon Con. But as actors found out, it's very tough going through customs saying, "Why are you here? I'm here for Armageddon Con." The custom guy hears something very different. So they changed the name of that to Australian Movie and Comic Book Expo, AMC Expo, where had a lovely time, and I hosted the first annual Apollo Awards.
What were we giving these awards for? To whom were we giving them?
Well, it's a fan-based decided. So it's you go to a website, apolloawards.com.au, and then there's categories of different films and film categories like best brawl, greatest laser battle, whatever. And then amongst the eight nominees, everybody would vote on their favorite and then an award given.
Which is absolutely going to make sure that the right people get awarded the most deserving. For much the same way that every online poll in our current presidential season gets won by Donald Trump, including who won the debates, even though he didn't win any of them, didn't even come within sniffing distance of them. If you are aware of his performance,
of them, so yeah. I mean, like. I just read them. I didn't watch them because they come on
of course,
at 3 o'clock
of course.
In the morning.
And we'll talk about that later. But I just wanted to maybe throw the voting system under the bus. Anyway.
Oh, I see what you did.
Had you seen any of these? I mean, first of all, had you seen the people nominated in these categories?
Yeah. Well, some of them were like, you know, Doctor Who and Leonard Nimoy, you know, these kind of things. So there were some classics. And there were two categories. There was nostalgic and contemporary. So it wasn't strictly Australian-based. It was kind of a global, you know, picking your favorites.
So you're saying that there is something in contemporary culture that's not based on nostalgia? Well, that deserves an award right there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, there was a whole bunch of things. But, of course, I had to say there was a late edition. Because I improvised a sci-fi thriller in between awards, two or three awards given, and then I do another scene from my whatever epic thing, which turned out to be something entitled Drugs in Space. Highly entertaining.
Wow. So you brought a lot of the comedy to the award show. How long was this award show?
It went by pretty quickly, but it was about 100 minutes long, would we say? And I'll tell you what, you know, I'm a big fan of deep brain stimulation, the wire that's put in your head to stop all sorts of palsies and body shakes,
no one is a bigger fan of that than you.
Yeah, exactly. So inadvertently, I brought a guy up on stage who had one of those in his head for his Parkinson's disease, but he was one of the funniest improvisers, and they say it's a result of the brain stimulation, the deep brain stimulation that causes the part of his concentration or part of his brain to come up with really creative, hilarious responses in an improv. So from now on, I think I'm only want to improvise with people who have deep brain stimulation wires in their head.
Yeah, I was surprised that you said he had that wire, but he was a funny improviser. I mean, I don't know why that wouldn't help.
Wouldn't that help? Yeah, I know.
Getting poked by a wire somewhere certainly seems, from what I've seen, to help improv. Now, you are sniffing a la Donald Trump. What's going
yes.
on there?
Well, it's only a chilly 10 degrees Celsius here, which means it's 40 something. I'm not good at my translation. But it's a cold snap coming through Australia. There's an Antarctic wind blowing unseasonably cold air up through my shirt and into my nostrils, giving me the slight sniffles here.
So you're there in the Los Angeles of Australia, and it's been wintry cold, and even though it's spring, and I've been here right. in the Los Angeles of Los Angeles, and it's been 100 degrees, even though it's autumn.
Ah, so nothing's changed.
It's the hardest time of year for me always in Los Angeles, October, you know, where it's dry, it's dirty. We get those hot Santa Ana winds. Everything blows right up my nose. But it's been, I mean, there isn't a day without sinus pain, but it's been the easiest year on record, I think, for me. So,
oh, really?
Maybe I'm just getting too old to care.
which
is, I think, if we go to year 11 of this podcast, maybe that should be the new name. You know, we once did a name change before. Maybe
That's
we should
right.
just go bottom.
Rebrand it.
Yeah, bottom of the alphabet. We went from F's to C's because we thought higher up in the alphabet would be good, help people find us. But let's just screw it. We'll go right. to the bottom of the alphabet. We'll go to the bottom of the deck because we're too old to care. That would be
I like
really
it.
Funny, too old to care. All right. So you had a blast, apparently, hosting this thing. Now, my final question about these awards, were any of the recipients actually there?
No. I, in fact, accepted many on behalf of the recipients. And
did you make up reasons why they couldn't be there?
No. Oddly enough, I should have done that. That would have been funny. No, instead, I thanked the Academy, my agent, my manager, you know, families who supported me through all of the.
I think whoever had calculated the winners, knowing that they weren't going to be there, should have handed you the envelope along with maybe a suggested line of like where they were and why they, you know.
Yeah, that would have been good. But, you know, what was even funnier was that the list of nominees didn't match the PowerPoint presentation. So it was hilarious when you say, Serenity, and up comes a still for Star Trek for Next Generation. You know, that kind of wacky.
You know, not enough glamorous award shows are done on PowerPoint. Someday, that is the technology of the future. I would have loved if, please tell me, at least one you said rejected the award to protest the treatment of the Aboriginal people.
Ah, I missed that one too. Damn it.
Hey,
that'll be next.
I went to an event that you might have gotten a real kick out of yesterday. It was the 13th annual Halloween Morning with the U in there. Halloween Mornings.
Oh, right.
At the Heritage Square Museum over there off Avenue 43. What would that be? I mean, that's near Highland Park, yes. I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Just off the 110 sort of freeway.
We call that Mount Washington, I believe.
Is it still Mount Washington there? Okay. And anyway, it is, you know, Heritage Square is a terrific, terrific space in greater Los Angeles area. A whole lot of Victorian homes restored.
Right. That were transported on a flatbed truck from some other neighborhood.
By crane, actually, some of them. And there's some great photos of these things being done. And there's other buildings there, too, as well as a church. There's a vintage pharmacy, the interior of which is a working replica of what a 19-teens, a Prohibition-era pharmacy would have been. Front
awesome.
And back, so you can see the medicines being made. Hours can be spent just in that pharmacy looking at the products they have assembled.
Right.
They're for sale. And another one of the things there, I lived for many years after film school or during film school and then thereafter in an area of town called Palms, just north of Culver City, off of Motor Avenue. People can consult Google Earth. Motor was a road that was built to connect the old MGM studio, which would become Sony, with the Fox lot. And so all between there, the Studio Craftsman would live, for example. So it was always a nice film area residential neighborhood. And anyway, as you know, there was a train that used to connect downtown with the beach communities. Was
right.
I forget, what was that trolley line called? Was that the original Red Line? Or
that was the original Red Line, yes.
And there was a train depot there, the Palms Station, just around the corner from where I lived. It was no longer there by the time I lived there, of course. And
right.
Laurel and Hardy would use it as a film location set in Pottsville, fictional Pottsville. Anyway,
right.
That train depot was moved to Heritage Square and restored. And
I did not know that.
And it's the office now where you go into along with the gift shop to buy your tickets and visit the gift shop. And what is really cool is on the place where that train depot once stood, there is now once again a train depot, because of course we have the Expo line that goes all the
right.
way through from downtown to Santa Monica again. So it's amazing how time changes things, and then we come right back around to a new iteration of an old idea that worked.
I know that we dismantled our train system and then drove cars for 30 years and then went back to, hey, you know what's a good idea? Taking a train to the beach.
Especially if
Let's
you enjoy
that.
A pub crawl. Don't kid yourself. Heritage Square is such a fun spot, and so many movies and television shows have shot there, and it's great year round to go and get tours and of these Victorians. But it was especially fun for these Halloween mornings where they enacted Victorian era funerals and funeral processions. There were Victorian era Halloween parties in one of the houses, fall parties in another, seances in another. And you could explore, among other topics, the birth of spiritualism in the
wow.
United States, the birth of spirit photography, 3D photography, which dates back to the Civil War. In fact, most of the photos taken on battlefields during the Civil War were 3D photographs. And
were they?
So it an astounding array of experts and practitioners and reenactors taking place in these events. And I think even cynical Dean Haglund might have gotten a real kick out of it.
Wow, that sounds really fun. You know, Halloween parties, per se, aren't really my cup of tea. I do enjoy the Halloween
Victorian
evening.
Era Halloween parties, a little
yeah.
bit different kettle of fish, because, you know, it's interesting how, you know, you go to the UK, and I've learned about a little bit about Halloween trying to take root in Australia. Well, we get Halloween from the Irish and the Welsh immigrants to this country.
Ah,
and yet the practices that were partook of by the Irish and Welsh immigrants were a little more drunken and destructive, let's say.
Oh,
involved
really?
A lot more setting of fire to things than
right.
what we think of as Halloween now. And
but
so
that's tricksy. That's the trick of trick or treat, isn't it?
So well, there was no trick or treat was one of those things then that was invented to try to teach the youths a different path. because there was then, no treat. It was just trick. Halloween was just trick. And trick meant blow stuff up. And so they came up with, in the Victorian era, these rituals to try to curb the violence and replace it with a sense of fun for the young people. So anyway, well, it was but see there, your cynicism had to come out. You've never been to a Victorian Halloween party, and yet you were already going to put the kibosh on it.
Yeah, I wasn't going to put the kibosh. What I was going to say was that sounds more enjoyable than me, you know, being a stick in the mud at a regular Halloween party.
You know what was unacceptable was the fact that here it is, a Victorian-era event. Do I go in steampunk regalia at all? No. No, I do not.
What? What? I got you those steampunk glasses 3 years ago.
I should. I would have. It was 100 degrees, and I had such sinus pain.
Stick it on your bowler hat, for crying out loud.
I don't know. Is that a euphemism? All right. That's the ad line for next year's rebrand, Too Old to Care. Okay. Hey, I want to remind everyone, since we've been talking about these live events of which we partook, that on Sunday, November 13th, hell, you're coming back to town. Not in time for this.
Right. I'll miss it by a day.
A one-night revival at the Friendship Auditorium in Los Feliz of an LABC Home Companion, a tribute to the 91-year history of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, of which I am a proud member, and a celebration of a recently retired Garrison Keillor's run as the host of a Prairie Home Companion. We did this once before to great acclaim and success, so we're doing an even better version on November 13th. I encourage everyone within the sound of my voice to go to Encore Sundays .eventbrite.com and order a ticket and come and see me host this show.
I heard it's highly entertaining. I heard it from you.
The rumors are always true, even when they come from me. You know this. Well, Dean, speaking about Halloween, and, you know, I had heard from our friend and listener, Rob Jenkins, that there's a real effort to make Halloween a thing there in Australia. So my question to you is, are you going to show the locals a thing or two about Halloween spirit, if you will?
Well, we are. Last year, we were the only ones in our block to put out, we had candy at the door, but then we realized the kids were just going right by. So we actually sat out on the porch with the bowl of Choco Treats, as they call them, and watched the small, let's say 15 kids in total in a urban neighborhood, which is a small group. But I think once they heard that there was mini chocolate bars to be had, I think this will double the number this year, but maybe 30 kids. So we'll see. But that's that we're partaking like that. Some decorations in the window, of course, and scary stuff. But that's about as much as we're going to do.
It's like the audience size of your Too Old to Care show.
30 kids.
No, they are not legion, but they are mighty. And they're on the ground floor of something that will change the way people look at Halloween there in Australia for generations and generations to come. Do you dress up as anything for this occasion, Dean Haglund?
Well, see, I didn't bring a lot of my costume wardrobe stuff. I left a lot of that in LA. So my laser printed 3D latex Spock wig and ears and eyebrows, sadly, both of them sit collecting dust in the Eastern Columbia. And so I think I'm going to have to put my noggin on and come up with something, be it a robot, wear a cardboard box, and be a robot. That's always good, the classic go-to. But as of right now, I have no costume planned.
I am going to a Halloween party this weekend. A lot of parties this weekend. Halloween falls on a Monday, which is a little difficult for the adult parties. And I am going along with Lily Holloman, my better half, in grayscale.
Oh, from top to bottom. So you're going to have the 9 values from white to black, and each of the gray in between. as squares from top
no,
to bottom?
Not as a grayscale. We're going grayscale so that in person we are walking around as black and white photographs. We are walking around in black and white to all everyone's ocular perception. And, of course, what will be really great is we will, what do you call it? We'll photobomb everyone at these parties.
I see. And so it'll look like
so the next
just...
day they'll look at their photos when they sober up and they'll see black and white images within their color photographs.
Right, like somebody just desaturated you two in Photoshop.
People they won't know are showing up desaturated in their photos. Yes.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it turns out that it is a less arduous and complex makeup procedure than the blue man makeup I wore a couple of Halloweens past.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah.
That was arduous.
Yeah, that was fun. It turns out that was the single scariest costume, if you will, that I've ever donned in Halloween. I mean, that really spooked people.
Well, they thought you joined Blue Man Group in Vegas.
Well, when you just turn around and you're not expecting to, and yet you see staring inches away from you a bald-headed, head-to-toe blue human who is just wide-eyed and utterly silent. It's I don't think people are prepared for that.
Well, no, it's fine when it's on stage and there's, drumming and synthesizers. But, I think just seeing Blue Man Group hang around your house, that is a frightening aspect, I'm pretty sure. I think you're a precursor to the scary clown craze that's going on around the world.
There is no craze. There is no craze. Oh, my God. You know as well as I do that is such a hoax. But anyway,
yeah.
I mean, places won't sell clown costumes now because until the police get to the bottom of it. Get to the bottom of what? There's nothing.
There's a couple of idiots who stand around.
It was only reported on phony Canadian news sites. Like news sites that say on their masthead, this is comedy. Everything here is fiction. Anyway, all right. Much like on your Too Old to Care Anymore. So if people are looking for something, people want to stay in, maybe watch a scary movie, I can't encourage enough people listening to our episode 486, where we counted down our top 10 horror films of all time.
Right. How great was that?
So great that Rob Jenkins of Game Traders, he made a magazine article about it in their magazine Live. And I have gotten confirmation that the title of the magazine is pronounced Live, not Live. It's the same word, so I wasn't sure. And I think the example he gave me, I talked about this on the Midweek Drive this week, the example he gave me was it's like the Rolling Stones Live at Altamont. Well... okay, so that's how you're explaining it to me, but if I didn't know that album, I could think that the title was The Rolling Stones Live at Altamont. I mean, it's...
Right.
But anyway,
you're invited to their house at Altamont. It's a lovely album.
It's that favorite children's story about visit. Okay, so it's a great magazine, Live, and there's an article about it, but we encourage people to check out our list if they're looking for a classic horror film, maybe a lesser-known horror film, but these are all really good, and as we said, they're really, really scary, because that's what we were going after. So, our top 10. Now, speaking of horror... though voting has begun here in the USA with millions of people already having cast their ballots, this scorched earth presidential campaign just seems to continue with no end in sight. Quite frankly, I know November 8th is supposedly coming. I can see it on the calendar, but I swear to God, I look down the tunnel that we've been living in. There's no light at the end of it. There's just tunnel. There's just tunnel. We don't weigh in too much on this stuff too often, but I'm thinking that it might be fun, since Keith Olbermann doesn't have his own show anymore and doesn't do this. It might be fun occasionally to steal one of the segments he used to do, something called The Worst Person in the World. And I have a nomination for one such person. I was reading about how rancorous this election is and how perhaps one candidate, Donald Trump's, refusal to acknowledge that the reason he's going to lose is because people don't like him in great numbers, and instead say that the election is rigged, and how that might just inflame a violent response on the part of people in the wake of the election. Something right. that, you know, whatever one thinks about America, one of the things that has marked it is, in presidential history, a peaceful changeover of power.
Right.
And there's great worry that we're into uncharted waters here, especially when you read quotes like this from people attending Donald Trump's rallies. If she's in office, I hope we can start a coup. She should be in prison or shot. That's how yeah. I feel about it, says Dan Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. Dan is his first name. He's a 50-year-old contractor. And he said of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic nominee, we're going to have a revolution and take them out of office if that's what it takes. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed, but that's what it's going to take. I would do whatever I can for my country. So I'm going to make Dan Bowman, 50-year-old contractor, my nominee as our first worst person in the world. He's far from the only Trump supporter to go on record with similar sentiments, of course. But I'm singling out Dan Bowman, as the worst person in the world, because I love that it gives me the chance to point out that freedom of speech does not cover this kind of expression.
Right. This is, this goes into hate crime, as we call it, back in Canada and around the world.
It is a threat. So it is violent in its right. nature. Oh, man.
I know. And, you know, even if you disagree with policies and or criminal, a la, you know, my time in the George Bush administration, I disagreed with everything he said.
Wait a minute. You were in the George Bush administration? The conspiracy theorists are buzzing right now.
Technically, I had to, if politics does affect all of our lives in some manner, I did live in America during the Bush administration. So,
whereas I was one of the lucky ones that got out by hot air balloon.
All right, right. You spent those 8 years adrift around the world. So anyway, I made jokes. I whined about it, shook my head, knowing that this was a bad path to be taken to invading countries that didn't really provoke us. And there you go.
To advocate murder.
Yeah. Did I ever advocate murder? No, of course not. I think a revolution would have been good, but not a violent overthrow.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be
coup.
A violent, bloody coup. Why does there have to be the most successful revolutionaries of, I don't know, we can say recent vintage if we want to define the 20th century, right? The most successful revolutionaries in my mind were those that tended to advocate nonviolence.
Right.
And yes, they ended up dead. They ended up martyred, which makes it quite the path to walk. And yet they understood, right, that even free speech comes with accepting certain responsibilities for what you say. And one
Absolutely.
Of those things will be anger and violence directed against you. But to respond to what is going on by advocating murder, you're the worst person in the world, Dan Bowman. Whatever the hell. I'll reach out and find out the right pronunciation of his name. The good news, though, and there is good news, even though I don't enjoy dealing strictly in the positive, there is good news. And I say this to the people who are so freaked out about how many people are supporting not only Trump, but supporting him with such vitriol. Right.
Right.
Because the truth is, first of all, when I hear a lot of people who support Trump saying, yeah, I don't like him. Yeah, I think he's dangerous. And I think the policies that Hillary Clinton wants to adopt are more dangerous. Okay, there you go. I have no hatred or anger towards you at all. I might right. disagree with you, but that is a reasoned position. Now, through reasoned debate, might we get into that a little bit and might we have further disagreement? Yes, of course. But that is a position that I can say, okay, well, then you know the deal you are making for the vote you are casting. But this vitriol, this this violence, the misogyny and the racism that get expressed. How about just this concept, by the way, of Make America Great Again? You and I have right. talked about this before. When was it? When was it great again? You tell me when it was great before. I'll point out a group of people that had the boot heel on their throats.
Absolutely, yeah. If you go. Oh, well, you know, 91 was a good year. 1991. Let's make it 1991 again. Well, okay. How far away are we from that? Not this, you know, you're going to make gas 95 cents a gallon. Well, that's fine.
I just think you either need to say that America has always been great, always will be great, or greatness is always going to be a destination that we're striving to achieve.
Yes.
It's something that you can never truly achieve, yet it's the aim to go for, like being loving or being kind or being patient. You always have more work to do where that
Absolutely.
Is concerned. And maybe okay. greatness ought to be just that, right?
Right.
Anyway,
a destination.
What I wanted to say about the good news, though, is that
good news.
At most... for those people who are really disturbed by the furor coming from what seems to be a large group of the population, at most 60% of registered voters are going to turn out for this election. And registered voters only make up 52% of the U.S. population.
Right.
And Trump is going to end up with somewhere around 40% of the vote, which means approximately right. 40 million votes. In other words, only 24% of registered voters and only 12.5% of the population. So all Trump supporters are a niche group. Backers
right.
of both candidates are niche groups. But it means that in this instance, we all ought to breathe and relax a little bit. Knowing that no matter how hateful and hurtful some Trump supporters might seem to be, they mm-hmm. are, in fact, quite a minority. And and those who advocate violence, racism, misogyny are truly an inconsequential, wounded minority. And, of course, Donald Trump himself is one of that last group.
One of that group. So... this is not, as John Patrick Shanley wrote about, that this is a major rip in our social fabric that will take years to repair. You're suggesting that it is a minority, but vocal, getting tons of camera and airtime, but a niche, wounded, hurt group
will
dissipate.
It's a sizable enough group that's participating in this process. Right. 40% might support him. But truly, how many of those are the people that the Dan Bowmans of the world? How many are those?
Right.
A significantly smaller group. And then when
yeah.
you look at the overall size of the body of America that they represent, does it really surprise that maybe 5% of our public is really angry and prone to violence and hatred? I wouldn't say that 5 to 10% actually is that shocking a number or that terrifying a number.
Yeah, you know what? You just made me feel better about this whole election.
So
You're
there
right.
you go. What I there. Don't like, Dean Haglund, and boy, we're making this suddenly a political show. But what I don't yeah. like, on the other hand, is what's going on in this country right now, where all the down the ballot politicians. You know, the elections for Congress, let's say, or state Senate, or, you know, senator, governor, these elections, the down the ballot elections. There are so many campaigns right now where the sole campaign against competitors is if they support Trump. I'm getting a lot of election material sent to me, right? For example, in a local state Senate race between for someone to go to the state assembly, between Democrat Portantino and Republican incumbent Antonovich. And Portantino seems at best an ineffective and at worst a corrupt public servant. And Antonovich, well, he supports Trump. And that's the whole campaign that's being waged in favor of Portantino, is the other guy supports Trump. And I don't like that.
I think
we deserve better than that.
There should be a larger political discourse than that guy.
Yeah. If I'm all right in this instance, since it seems to be what it's about, and there's not anything I can do about it, much of the campaign between Clinton and Trump being a referendum on their fitness to hold office rather than policy.
Right.
But down the ballot, the rank and file, the people who really are doing things that affect us on a daily basis, their campaigns, really, we deserve better than having it be the same referendum about the two people who are at the top of the ballot.
Yeah, this doesn't bode well. Of course, I had to vote already, being overseas and an expat. Mine was mailed in on the weekend, or faxed in, never mind. So all of this now is completely out of my head because I'm already done.
Wow, I voted as well. And I think maybe then I might use the little I voted sticker in Monday's Instagram post, because every week we make a little Instagram post. People can find us at Dean and Phil, spell out and, hashtag we give good hashtag. So look forward to that. You know, I was visiting my family, and they live in, as you know, an agricultural area of California, which is contained within the battling 10th congressional district. And there is quite a Donnybrook shaping up between incumbent Jeff Denham and challenger Michael Eggman. And I don't vote in that election, so you would think I have no dog in the fight. But again, visiting, you can't escape how they are campaigning. And that got my hackles up a little bit against both of these men. First of all, I am hugely disappointed that at no point does challenger Michael Eggman claim in any of his advertising that he is the walrus.
I am the Eggman.
Cuckoo, ka-choo.
See,
Jeff Denham, on the other hand, is exactly the kind of politician we need far fewer of. His attack ads against Eggman take on Eggman's support for the bullet train by simply making fun of the idea of a bullet train.
Well, okay. What has anybody taken a bullet train in that area? In Europe,
because,
like in France?
You know why no one has? Because for decades, politicians like Jeff Denham have blocked it by making fun of it.
I know, but everywhere else in the world, the bullet train is such a fantastic way to travel. And if there was ever a state that would benefit from a high-speed train, it's California. So I don't understand why everyone...
So just making fun of the idea, you know, and that makes me so angry. You know, if you've got data that says, look, we can't afford it, or this is going to pull jobs away from something else, or whatever, have an argument. Don't make fun of it. But it gets worse. Jeff Denham also attacks Michael Eggman for his stance when Eggman has said publicly that he will protect the environment at all costs. And it's that at all costs that's the basis of a lot of Jeff Denham ads against Eggman. You know, with the tone of, really, at all costs? You'll protect the environment even if it kills jobs? Not saying that it will, just saying, really, at all costs? What if it threatens lives? You would still prefer the environment over people? I mean, these are the kind of ads that are being run. And this guy, Jeff Denham, who is the incumbent, who claims to be a farmer, though he's certainly a veteran and certainly a multimillionaire and a career politician for at least a decade, as opposed to Michael Eggman, who has been working as a farmer. But his ads in favor of himself Boy, the voiceover is great. Realize that this is for the 10th congressional district, right? And
right.
The ads begin, ISIS is an enemy hell-bent on destroying us. And Jeff Denham will wipe them off the face of the planet.
What?
Yeah, exactly. So a congressman serving an agricultural area is running on his personal battle against ISIS? I leave you with this. Here is, I got some hidden wiretapped recording of Jeff Denham's campaign manager whispering in Jeff Denham's ear.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons.
That was, of course, Gene Wilder, the late, great Gene Wilder in Blazing mm-hmm. Saddles, talking to Cleavon Little, which operates as a lovely segue to a little discussion about last week's episode 492, where we discussed and counted down our top 10 all-time favorite Westerns.
Right.
People,
how fun was that?
People loved this show, Dean. They
yes.
loved it.
I'm surprised to hear that.
Really? I guess I was too. I wasn't surprised that people would love it, but I didn't know that it would be such a big audience. I thought maybe this was a niche because, of course, you know, Westerns are not the most popular genre anymore. But
right. But
it really seemed to be a show not only that people really loved, but that a lot of people gravitated towards. And again, our friends at Game Traders are going to turn that show into an article. Of their magazine Live, which I'm glad about because, again, as I said, Australia is helping to keep Westerns alive in terms of at least the production of them.
Yes, for sure.
May Garcia, our regular listener, tweeted, actually, as soon as it was done, "Oh, gob, that was excellent." I mean, when you get a gob.
An excellent gob.
Barely after the show is over, you know it must
not
be good.
Not since the third grade did I get an excellent gob. I'm telling you.
Our friend Alex Lefchuk, host of the aforementioned Midweek Drive, was upset that we did not include the James Stewart vehicle Shenandoah.
Oh.
Though, as I pointed out to him, even if we wanted to, and we didn't. It was not eligible because it takes place in Virginia. Not the American
right.
West during the Civil War. It's a Civil War film, not a Western film.
Good point.
Yeah.
But there's always a lot of blending of Civil War stories in
sure,
Westerns.
Sure, but I would have really, I mean, as we talked about with the definition we were going under, that would not, so you can't have it be set in Virginia and have it be a Western. That's an Eastern.
Yeah. That's an Eastern.
Now, I wanted to point out to you a couple things that I learned in the wake of that show. First of all, you called your film, your selection, Cowboy, starring Jack Lemmon, a guilty pleasure. Okay,
yes.
That's what you said. What you failed to mention was that it was directed by Delmer Daves and starred Glenn Ford, that they had reteamed almost immediately after 310 to Yuma to make it. And, oh, by the way, 310 to Yuma had been my preceding selection that we had talked about. And you mentioned nothing about their reteaming. And so anyway, I'm ever more excited to see this film. It sounds fantastic. and I'm amazed because Delmer Daves, who was best known for Westerns, I think, and maybe war pictures, but also noirs.
Yeah.
He worked on a couple of the formative Humphrey Bogart movies. He, in between 310 to Yuma and Cowboy, took time to direct the romance classic An Affair to Remember.
Wow.
With Cary Grant. How about cleansing your palate between two Western films with Glenn Ford by doing a four hanky weepy?
Totally. I had no idea that was the same director on that one.
John Wayne's gesture at the end of The Searchers was not a tribute to silent film cowboy Tom Mix.
Wait.
As you suggested. Harry Carey, Harry Carey was the star to whom John Ford and John Wayne were paying tribute. Tom Mix was a great silent Western star. I think he starred in 231 films, all but 9 of which were silent films. But Harry Carey was a friend of John Ford's, and he was Wayne's favorite cowboy actor. And Wayne, in fact, got to co-star with him in The Angel and the Bad Man.
That's right.
And the story becomes really touching when you realize that Harry Carey's widow, Olive Carey, plays Mrs. Jorgensen in The Searchers. And she is in that final scene where Wayne pays tribute to her late husband. And immediately, apparently recognizing the tribute during that take, she immediately broke into tears.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So I knew all that story. I got the name wrong. I apologize. Did not do well. I didn't know you were picking The Searchers as your thing. So my.
Well, no, I just want to go. It's not a correction. I'm not. It's not about winning.
All right.
It's more. It was a really good story, and I wanted to make sure that people got the details of it. And as much as I loved The Searchers, I had never known that story. So this is teamwork. And when you have to do a show. Get to do a show week after week, whether you want to or not, even if you're too old to care anymore, it affords you the opportunity to delve a little bit deeper. We're hopefully going to delve pretty deep when we do another top 10 in the not-too-distant future of most overlooked sci-fi films of all time. We are, as I say, delving deep. These are the deep cuts on the album. And not necessarily the best films, just ones that for whatever reason we think are incredibly overlooked to the point that we might not even be able to explain why they were overlooked.
Right.
Rob Jenkins of Game Traders sent us an interesting suggestion, and I got a bunch of promising suggestions from Alex Lefchuk, so we'll look forward to doing that. And we've had the request several times now that we do a top 10 all-time musical films. So that might need to be one in the near future as well.
I like that.
Let's let go of Westerns, you know, I've been watching the TV series Westworld, as you know, on HBO.
And your review wasn't as glowing as many of the other ones I've seen online.
No, I loved it. I criticized one thing, only one thing. I've been loving it. I've been saying it's right up there with Mr. Robot and the Prisoner, for crying out loud. But I criticized the introduction of two human characters who were meant to follow, and we got a letter about that. Why don't I read this? Last week,
the letter.
Phil mentioned the incongruity of the humans visiting Westworld, where one character was a scum and the other seemed too nice to be with him. And I'm going to read a little bit more of this, even though what I was saying was misunderstood. I just watched the original Westworld film for the first time last week, and the human visitors to Westworld are portrayed by James Brolin, a slick kind of scummy operator who is there to get his kicks immorally, while he is accompanied by his friend, played by Richard Benjamin, a nice guy coming off of a bad marriage and divorce who's facing moral uncertainty regarding how he can interact with the robots. When I saw the scene of the two men arriving in Westworld on HBO, it is very, very similar to how it was portrayed in the movie. This is all true. In the movie, the pairing felt more natural since the viewer would think Brolin was the suave single 70s guy and Benjamin the confused newly divorced man trying to adapt to his new single status. All true. On the show, I think it was supposed to be the meek guy's bachelor party, and he is a new visitor who is also unsure where he fits in the Westworld universe. Okay, this is all true. The point that I was getting to was that I was taken out of the...
Yes.
My suspension of disbelief was punctured because I could not believe that these two actors were friends, that these two characters were friends, that they would spend time together. This is a big thing for me. I may have mentioned when I'm teaching my acting classes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems
believability.
Right. Why are you friends? And it's a challenging thing because a lot of times writers don't put that in. Directors don't know, but it is incumbent upon actors that we need to glimpse the friendship that existed prior to whatever acrimony might presently exist. We need to believe it so that we can believe the stakes. And if we can't believe this, well, then we have a hard time believing things like robots walking around.
exactly. Right?
Because honestly, the human characters aren't believable enough to even be robots. So the very next episode, they do explain why they're together, which is that the one character, the nice character, the meek character, is apparently marrying the other character's sister. And they're therefore kind of forced to be together.
They'll still be brother-in-laws.
Still a weakness in that that probably ought to have been introduced earlier so that we aren't scratching our heads going, why would he even care?
Right.
But it was explained away. So there you go. Thanks. The email ends, love the podcast, Les. So thank you, Les.
Yeah. Thanks, Les.
And keep on listening. Other shows I've been watching, I got to do a little bit of a mea culpa on a show that I had turned my back on after about four episodes of season two, and that was Daredevil.
Oh, yeah.
I finally watched the rest of season two of Daredevil, and it gets very good. Very good. The first four episodes were so badly missing the structure that was presented in season one, where we're developing the Daredevil character and the character of Wilson Fisk, played by the peerless Vincent D'Onofrio. And the first four episodes of season two seemed to be trying so many different plots, tried to be exploring so many different characters, and none of them were interesting. But really what ends up happening is by season five, they've got all the players on the board and then they start adding level after level and even more characters to the mix and it starts to work.
Oh,
so,
well, that's curious. So I should binge watch this, speed through season two and, settle in for season four or five.
Season two is all that exists. One and then season two, binge watch the first four, even though they're really rough, and then cleanse your palate and know that you're in for quite a fun ride, for the rest of the 13 episodes of season two. I am really looking forward to this coming weekend here in the States on Netflix, season three of Gillian Anderson's series, The Fall, is released.
Yes.
It's been airing there on the BBC in the UK, and the first two seasons of this were so good.
Yeah, she's been doing a fantastic job as a nailing that character, and I've only watched a couple of episodes of just season one, so that I can again sit down and see it all in one go. But all the fans been loving her work, and I have been too.
One of the shows that I've talked about a little bit that I've been looking forward to that's been in development. You remember that Caleb Carr book, The Alienist?
Yes.
That we both love so much. It was developed as a television series for TNT. And Carrie Fukunaga, who directed every episode of season one of True Detective on HBO, whose contribution to that show, I think, was really unsung at the time. And in retrospect, everyone understands, boy, he really was a key reason why season one was so successful. He was assigned to direct the episodes of The Alienist, but he stepped down. And he was going to write and direct every episode, and he's been replaced by, on the other hand, Jacob Verbruggen, whose television credits include Black Mirror, which I have not seen but have heard wonderful things about.
Yeah.
And the aforementioned The Fall. He is directing every episode instead. So at least apparently they are they're replacing with quality.
Well, that's pretty cool.
For people who don't know, it's a psychological thriller set in the Gilded Age of 1896 New York, a city of vast wealth, extreme poverty, and technological innovation. When a series of haunting, gruesome murders of prostitutes gripped the city, newly appointed police commissioner Theodore Roosevelt calls upon criminal psychologist, a.k.a. alienist, Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler and newspaper reporter John Moore to conduct the investigation in secret. And it really focuses on the development of forensic practices that are still in place to this day.
Wow. It's sort of like the Murdoch Mysteries, the Canadian TV series of a turn-of-the-century detective who, you know, invents items unbeknownst to the rest of the world in his crime-fighting activities. It's quite funny, actually.
I noticed that with not glee, I must say, with some real disappointment, the Gotham Award nominations have come out, and these are independent film award that are given out annually. So it means that the season of self-congratulation has already begun.
Fantastic. But start early.
But I'm more interested in touching on briefly a whole bunch of films that are in development and giving a thesis that I would like you to think about that maybe we can get into on next week's show. Because we talk so much about remakes and adaptations and sequels and the whole concept from a corporate point of view behind them, i.e. risk management, which ironically often leads not only to creative bankruptcy, but to actual bankruptcy for the companies that are so slavishly devoted to this practice.
Right.
We've got Disney is full on in the live action adaptation business now. I mean, in the wake of The Jungle Book and their Cinderella, you know, they're doing live action Lion King. They're doing two Mulans. They've got Aladdin being directed by Guy Ritchie.
Wow.
Even as the first trailer for John Wick comes out, comes the announcement that John Wick 3 is already going into production. J.K. Rowling's first installment of Magical Beasts and Where to Find Them opens on November 18th. And she wrote it, by the way. She's writing the screenplays to these, as opposed to the Harry Potter series, where they were adapted from her works with her supervision. But she's writing these scripts. No, that hasn't even come out yet. And instead of the planned trilogy, she's already announced it's going to be 5 films. In the wake of the sleeper success of the summer comedy movie Bad Moms, a spinoff called Bad Dads is going to be made, which, yeah, is really a bad idea because they do realize that what made Bad Moms appealing was that it was a riff on every other comedy we get, which could be called Bad Dads.
Yeah, totally.
But again, instead of decrying all this from the quote-unquote creative or corporate point of view, I was really thinking a lot about how this kind of all fuels the audience's need to know as much as possible about a film before they see it.
Right. Why now? This is this is the thesis that you're thinking of.
Yeah.
What is it in our psyche that we need to know everything about the movie before we're going to put down our $20 to go see it?
You know, I talk a lot about the nostalgia of it and the comfort food element of it and all of this, but might there not be also just an element in this that is akin to why trailers show so much of the movie?
Right.
And they would not do that. These people would not do that to the degree they do if they didn't have reams of data showing that those are the trailers that are effective with audiences.
So, this is curious because
if you're getting an adaptation, a live adaptation, well, you already know the story and you know how it turns out.
Right.
So you know it's something that's going to please you already. There isn't an audience has to operate on their own risk management because of limitations of time and money and attention span and all of this, right? Emotional limitations.
But isn't it also like a small child wants to hear the same story read again and again as in bedtime story until one day they just don't want to hear it again and they've grown out of it. But until then, They need that story repeated to them time and time again in order for it to galvanize something in the psyche that then allows it to grow and move on.
Well,
is that happening to us?
And is the storyteller's responsibility to give the people what they want or to give the people what they need? Which can be a different thing. So let's talk about this next week. And close with, and honestly, as good as Rogue One, Star Wars Rogue One looks, and that trailer looks great, this is the ultimate expression of it, isn't it? Because we all know what happens.
Right. Yeah. We've seen parts 1 through 7
We
on that
know
one,
what
so...
happens to those plans.
Yep. Exactly.
Me thinks they work. Anyway, spoiler alert.
Totally. They get the plans.
Anyway, I close with a little bit of self-congratulation on our part. Again, our audience might not be legion, but clearly they are powerful. And no sooner do I complain on this show about Benicio del Toro agreeing to star in a new Predator reboot, saying, you know, we don't need Predator movies. We need Benicio del Toro movies. Then Benicio del Toro drops out.
So he listens to our show.
Or Chilpack Nation got on him and helped him see the error of his ways, and he dropped out with something known as the old, quote, scheduling conflict. One can only wonder if it's akin to the scheduling conflict for Suicide Squad that caused Tom Hardy to drop out, and when I say drop out, shred the script and send it back to them. For those of you who do need more Predator movies, Boyd Holbrook, the star of Netflix series Narcos, will be replacing Benicio del Toro, and Boyd Holbrook, the star of Narcos, replacing him is just another reason why I conveniently don't have to give a fuck about another Predator movie. So that's the good news. Brings us to an end of another interesting
installment
of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review on iTunes. How hard is that?
What could be more fun? People should like us on Facebook.
Yes, at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Please like us.
Yes, you can write us like so many people do at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com and follow us on the Twitter and the Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. And look at those hashtags on Instagram.
Oh, my
good Lord, man. That must take all day.
I have a team that works on them around the clock. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.